May it please the court, my name is Stephen Horwitz and I represent the plaintiff appellants in this case as well as one cross appellee. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The plaintiffs in this appeal were passed over for promotions to the ranks of police lieutenant and police captain in the Chicago Police Department in 1990 and 1991. Now, the role of the jury in this trial was to answer 23 special verdicts, and those special verdicts were premised on the assumption that the city had presented some evidence in the record for the factual proposition asserted, and the jury was asked whether or not the plaintiffs disproved those factual assertions. But the jury's answers to those special verdicts in the city's favor were really besides the point. The ultimate question was whether a strong basis in evidence existed that justified the highly suspect undertaking of affirmative action. And as the party stipulated, strict scrutiny required that judicial inquiry was for the district court to determine if there was a substantial or a strong basis in evidence. The first issue I would like to direct to is the district court's determination that there was a strong basis in evidence that there was intentional discrimination in the hiring of blacks between 1963 and 1969, the critical period in this case.
Now, I didn't understand what you said about the jury. What are we supposed to do with these special verdicts?
Well, in this case, the special verdicts were, it was assumed that the city had placed some evidence in the record on each of the proposals.
I don't know what you mean by it was assumed.
Well, the city, all they have to do is put in some evidence. It was a burden of production. Whatever, any type of evidence.
I don't understand you. What are we supposed to do with these findings? Are we supposed to take them as truthful or what?
I believe not. In the sense that,
so you're saying they're not supported by the evidence?
Well, for purposes of the strict scrutiny, the strong basis in evidence.
I don't understand strict scrutiny has anything to do with the evidence. I don't get with it.
Well,
what happened? It's just the jury decides what happened, and then the judge has to decide whether that's an excuse for discrimination.
Well, when you look at the strong basis in evidence, for example, there was...
What are you talking about?
Well, if I may give you an example. There was evidence in the record that there were no blacks hired by...
Why don't we look at a finding? Is there a specific finding you quarrel with?
Well, for example, the finding that there was intentional discrimination in the hiring of blacks prior to 1990.
So you're saying that that's clearly erroneous?
I think even based upon the record evidence in this case, yes, because the only evidence...
Okay, so it's not irrelevant. I understand why you said it was beside the point. If that's clearly erroneous, then we disregard it, but if it's not, then...
But why would the clearly erroneous requirement apply to the jury's findings? Are you saying these were advisory findings?
Well, they weren't advisory, but since it's the unique case of strict scrutiny, the court has a role to play.
And oh, definitely. And if we think of Ornelas, I think we have a model for these kinds of constitutional questions that partake both of important constitutional legal standards and also underlying facts. And there are underlying facts that the trier of fact will find. And then, after all is said and done, the court will look at it and see whether the standard has been met.
If I might, then the basis for which the court determined that the key issue was what was the reason for the sharp decline in black hires in 1963 to 1969.
Now, is it your position there was not evidence on both sides of that question? I know you rely on the LEAA report.
Right.
And there was evidence on the city side to the contrary, that the LEAA report was not, in fact.
Well, the only evidence, if I might, was the testimony by their statistician, Siskin, who admitted he has no expertise regarding job interest.
They had a lot of anecdotal evidence as well, did they not?
Not on, there was anecdotal evidence which the LEAA report clearly refuted.
I'm just trying to figure out, do we have a situation here where there's some evidence on one side, some evidence on the other side, which seems to be what Judge Lindbergh thought, one of his minute orders particularly notes this, where a trier of fact is going to have to resolve that issue, because it strikes me that you're saying that the LEAA report is so powerful that no rational human being could find anything but that there was a discrimination-free environment through the 60s.
I think that's true. Because the only evidence of intentional discrimination is the disparity. There is no evidence like there was in the firefighters' case that there was racial policies by the by the fire commissioner Quinn. There's absolutely no evidence of that sort in this case.
You think we should simply disregard the combination of the statistical evidence plus the anecdotal evidence to show and just say, well, it was never there?
Well, the statistical evidence is there, obviously.
Well, are you asking us to weigh the evidence de novo, or what way are we supposed to give
this, this court has said that.
Well, don't interrupt me.
Okay.
What weight should we give to the jury's finding? The jury found there was intentional discrimination against blacks in the 60s.
That's
now,
right.
What weight are we supposed to give to that finding?
Well, we have
Zero
to.
Weight?
Well, we have to look at what the evidence was.
No, what weight do we give it as a finding? What is our standard of review of that fact finding?
We defer to it in the sense that we do defer to it. There's some.
Right.
Well, it's more than some evidence. We do defer to it. However, in deferring to it, when we look in this case, that even under the clearly erroneous standard, when there's documentary evidence that refutes implausible statements by witnesses, the documentary evidence should...
What legal authority can you cite me that Rule 52 has anything to do with review of jury findings under Rule 49?
I don't judge.
I'm not aware of any case that said that.
Well,
indeed, the Seventh Amendment comes into play if you've got a jury that's not an advisory jury making fact findings.
Well, but in the Dishnow case, where a constitutional issue was raised, the court did find that the jury's findings are really beside the point.
Well,
that's beside the point. It's such a puzzling way to put it. First, you say that we owe the usual deference to fact findings by the trier of fact, whether it's judge or jury. Then you say the findings are beside the point. So which is it?
Well, I think in this case, it is besides the point, Your Honor. I think in this case, even if you apply...
Lost me completely. How do we defer to jury findings and yet regard them as beside the point?
Well, I think that because of you have to have a substantial basis and an evidence, that the jury's findings was based upon all the...
Did you just say the findings are seriously erroneous? Is that what you just meant?
I am saying that. That is correct. And that is based...
The jury's findings.
The jury's findings, based upon the evidence in the record. For example, the judge determined that the sharp downfall was due to intentional discrimination because it wasn't happening elsewhere. Well, Croson says you cannot extrapolate what happens in other jurisdictions to determine discrimination in another jurisdiction. Furthermore, the evidence
That's a different point in Croson.
Furthermore, you
can't assume that one group is being discriminated against in Virginia because it's being discriminated against in some other state. But it's another thing to use experiences that are happening otherwise in other states to try to figure out why there was this drop off in applications in the 60s.
Well, there was
what's wrong with that?
But the question of what the job interest, which goes to job interest. System, the city's expert admitted he had no.
You made all these arguments in the district court.
That's correct. I did make those arguments.
So why did they fail?
I wish I had them, but I'm not. I don't know why they failed, Judge.
Well, apparently these witnesses that you describe as implausible, or apparently the jury found them credible.
Well, if I might, for example,
what are we supposed to do that?
The record about the medical exam, that there was a high disproportion of people being blacks being weeded out for flat feet and heart murmurs is absolutely not true. If you look at the, I mean, sure, people said that, but if you look based on the testimony of a guy like Furman Duplessis, he said 87% of the people in his class were black failed because of flat feet.
But the bottom line, though, was that the evidence showed that African Americans were failing the medical exam at a practically double rate until the period of time begins where this record establishes that we do have a non-discriminatory environment, at which point the blacks suddenly become healthy. And the district court said, okay, that's a piece of evidence. Why would they overnight, have a health profile that looks just like
Well, the courts, they said that there's two suspect categories were flat feet and heart murmurs. And in those categories, there was no difference.
Well, but the bottom line was the bottom line. The jury had that in front of it, did it not?
Yes, it did.
And so the jury could have said, gee, all of a sudden, when it becomes non-discriminatory, these health issues evaporate.
Well, that only goes to the issue of that that they did.
It was a pretext that there was discrimination going on. It's a piece of evidence the jury might have thought was telling.
Well, that's all you have is a disproportionate impact, but you have no...
No, the jury can infer from the evidence. The jury wasn't asked, was there a disproportionate impact? The jury was asked, was there intentional discrimination? And sometimes circumstantial evidence proves that. Look at cases like Castaneda against Partita. Look at cases like Village of Arlington Heights. I mean, there are a lot of cases that say you can have circumstantial evidence of intentional discrimination. Right.
Well, but again, we have there was evidence the fact that, for example, in the area of eye examinations, twice as many whites failed for eyes as blacks. I mean, they're to say that it suggests that there was discrimination in that portion of the exam. And the matter is that six times as many African Americans failed the written exam, and there's absolutely no evidence that the written exam was intentionally discriminatory.
But in fact, that's the virtue of using as a baseline the non-discriminatory period. It's going to capture a lot of differences between communities so that we know what it looks like when there's no discrimination. We can compare the question period with that. If the written exam had disproportionate rates, if there were health issues, if there were other things, we'd pick it up in the comparison, would we not?
Well, but this court has held, and the fact as a matter of judicial estoppel, that the pre-72 examination process was not intentionally discriminatory. On that basis alone, plaintiffs
should... That's not quite what was said in the case.
Well, the court held that...
It hadn't been asked.
Well, the court... There was a 60-day trial where the Justice Department attempted to prove intentional discrimination in hiring and promotions by the city of Chicago.
That's not what the Justice Department was trying to prove. They were trying to prove a constitutional violation, and they didn't think they needed to prove intentional discrimination because Washington against Davis hadn't been decided yet.
Well, but they attempted to prove it. It was a pattern and practice case.
That's different.
Well, pattern of practice, if I might, is based on intentional discrimination, widespread racial motives. It is an intentional discrimination case, as the court Supreme Court held in Teamsters. That is based on intentional discrimination.
Also a case decided after these events, but anyway.
So, and this court held that there was not purposeful discrimination just by the fact of discriminatory impact in any portions of the exam, the written, the medical, the assignments, which the court found there was no intentional discrimination there, and again,
it's one thing to say there's no conclusion of intentional discrimination. It's another thing to say the evidence that you have presented didn't necessarily require a finding of intentional discrimination. And of course, this is now very well established that discriminatory impact isn't enough to satisfy a burden of proving intentional discrimination.
Yeah. But that was litigated, and since it was fully litigated, that issue in 1970, judicial estoppel principle should apply here. Now, with respect to the lieutenant promotions, there's also reasons why this court should review it under the strict scrutiny standard, which this court in Billish said when you disregard rank order in examinations, that strict scrutiny requires to determine whether there's a pretext. Here, the city pledged to Judge Marshall that after the 87 lieutenant's exam was race norm, that they would go in rank order. And in fact, they went in rank order for several years. All of a sudden, in 1989, they decided to do non-rank order promotions. And as a matter of law, that was in violation of the city's citywide affirmative action plan, which said that the judgment of Judge Marshall and Bigby, which did not contain any quotas, would be followed in lieutenant promotions. Hilby Roth says when you disregard the affirmative action plan, and there's no basis in it, then the affirmative action plan is, as a matter of law, improper. Here the city did that. They said they would follow the judgment in Bigby, and they disregarded the judgment in Bigby, that there would not be any non-rank order promotions in the rank of lieutenant. Similarly, the city jettisoned, for purposes of this appeal, the very type of statistical comparison it did that led it to affirmative action. That statistical comparison, an inter-rank comparison, showed no type of statistical disparities between sergeant and lieutenant. And they jettisoned that in this case and went on a different theory. Again, the affirmative action plan said it was based on inter-rank comparisons, and when those inter-rank comparisons were properly done, they showed no disparity. Hilby Ross, again, requires that, that as a matter of law, that the failure to follow the plan means that the plan should be, that the affirmative action plan should be overturned. With respect to the five females and three blacks who the jury voted in the plaintiff's favor, that even though there was past discrimination, that these positions need not be filled by additional blacks and women, that is not determined by the strict scrutiny standard, so since the strict scrutiny standard only goes to the defense of affirmative action, not to the plaintiff's case. Here the five plaintiffs, the plaintiffs, there was enough evidence to show that women, even prior to 63, or in the 63 to 69 period, would not have applied to jobs as police officers. There was a showing that only 12% of women who were police women who were offered a chance to be police officers in 1970 took that up. Now, even today, there's only a 25% hiring ratio of police women compared to their 50% of the population. Furthermore, there was another non-discriminatory reason regarding women because of the height requirement, which was 5 feet 7, and that would have disqualified 65% of the women. While that may not have, that would not be satisfied Title VII in the 63-69 period, that was a facially neutral proposition. Finally, with respect to...
You're using up your rebuttal time. You want to reserve that?
I will reserve it, thank you.
Mr. Rosen?
Thank you, Judge Posner, and may it please the Court. This morning I will address two issues. First, whether the promotion of African Americans pursuant to this affirmative action plan was a narrowly tailored remedy for prior discrimination. And second, whether there was a compelling justification for increasing racial diversity, in particular with respect to Hispanics at the rank of lieutenant and captain, subject of our cross-appeal. With respect to the promotion of African Americans, the district court found that underrepresentation at the ranks of captain and lieutenant was the result of prior discrimination, relying on evidence indistinguishable in any meaningful sense from the evidence that this court held properly supported a verdict in the Majeski case. Indeed, on remedial aspects of this case, there is no meaningful distinction between this case and Majeski. The very same affirmative action directive of July 1990 gave rise to the plan in Majeski as well as the plan here, and it was supported by the same types of evidence. First, the statistical evidence, which in particular in this case made clear that there was no non-discriminatory explanation for the plunge in African-American hiring that began in 1962. Statistics addressed the potential non-discriminatory explanations and refuted them, in particular with respect to African-American interests.
Would you like to address for just a minute the issue of the standard of review of the jury's responses to the interrogatories we were discussing with Mr. Horwitz?
In our view, to the extent, now the district court set aside some of the interrogatory answers and others.
It did a couple of different things, right? It has the retrial on two of them. It decides that one of them is simply not supported by the evidence. So how do we view...
With respect to the interrogatory answers that were not set aside by the district court, our view is, the ordinary scope of review is that if any reasonable trier of fact on this record could have reached those conclusions, they should be sustained. Now, we then add that because the plaintiff actually never moved for judgment as a matter of law on any of these special findings, they actually waived their right to argue in this court that any of those special findings were unsupported by the evidence. Now, we then agree, of course, that once the historical facts as found either at the first trial by the jury or at the second trial by the judge, the historical facts, once they are found and taken in the light most favorable to the judgment, should be reviewed independently on appeal, because this is a strict scrutiny case. But we do think the underlying historical facts are either reviewed under the standard for jury verdicts, and we think there's been a waiver in this case, or with respect to the second trial, the facts found at the second trial, we think the clearly erroneous standard governs.
Is there any difference? Clearly erroneous. Is there any difference in the scope of review of jury and judge fact findings?
Well, the Supreme Court tells us that maybe there's a smidgen more review on appeal of a jury finding than of a judge's finding rather than a jury trial by virtue of the Seventh Amendment. In this case, we don't see any practical difference, especially because of the waiver problem that pervades the jury's findings. And with respect to clearly erroneous, the phrase clearly erroneous just doesn't appear in the blue brief. So we just don't find any argument in the blue brief that these findings were clearly erroneous. The statistical evidence, of course, was supplemented by historical evidence of discrimination. Again, indistinguishable from the evidence in Majeski. In fact, most of the same witnesses who testified in Majeski testified in this case. In particular, pretextual hiring practices, enormous adverse impact on African Americans, for example, as a result of the medical test. And the evidence was Alderman Dupre, for example, adopted a practice of telling African Americans that had been bounced by the medical to go to their own doctors, and their own doctors couldn't find anything wrong with them. He'd send them back to the police department, the police department still wouldn't hire them. There was deposition testimony from a doctor who was examining people that had been disqualified by the medical screening. He could find nothing wrong with them. There was also ample evidence that the Chicago Police Department tolerated, indeed encouraged, an environment of racial harassment, out-and-out institutional racism. And of course, it's so interesting that this all coincides with the end of formal segregation in the Chicago Police Department in 1962.
Didn't the city lose federal funding?
Eventually, Judge Marshall impounded all federal funding because of the city's refusal to comply with his court orders, and the city still would not comply with Judge Marshall's orders until this court finally affirmed Judge Marshall on appeal, and then the city reluctantly and in the face of great hostility and folk dragging came into compliance with Judge Marshall's orders. The affirmative action plan at issue, we also submit, was a narrowly tailored remedy for that prior discrimination. The plan remediated the shortfall caused by prior discrimination. The promotions were within the outer boundaries of the shortfall caused by prior intentional discrimination, and it imposed no undue burden on non-minorities. Indeed, of the 182 promotions to lieutenants, only 17 were not in rank order. Of the 50 promotions to captain, only 3 were not in rank order. That leads me to the subject of our cross-appeal, the operational justification for the promotions of minorities, and in particular I will focus on the promotion of Hispanics because that is the issue squarely presented by our cross-appeal.
But of course, I mean, on the facts, you've got a tough row to hoe on the cross-appeal because the jury finds that there wasn't a problem with Hispanics at the relevant time period, and also, I'm not sure of what legal relevance this is, but you seem to have a fairly unattractive person, not personally, but I mean in terms of the bona fides of this individual's Hispanic character. He may be a perfectly nice guy for all I know, but it's, as an Hispanic, he seems to be a latecomer.
Well, the jury found that there was no remedial justification with respect to Hispanics, and we don't present a remedial justification on appeal. With respect to the specifics of Mr. Denk, the plaintiffs make a mountain out of one molehill, which is that Mr. Denk was not listed as Hispanic until 1990. What the evidence showed is that it didn't matter whether he was being carried as Hispanic or not until 1990. That was when affirmative action began.
Well, the name isn't Hispanic.
And the evidence
also... the plaintiffs also say that he doesn't know Spanish. What is his Hispanic background?
Mr. Dank was required to provide documentation of Hispanic background. It came through his mother. And there's certainly no argument that affirmative action is only permissible if your Hispanic background comes through your father rather than your mother. Ironically, in Latin America, where Mr. Dank comes from, people carry their mother's last name. So he wouldn't be named Dank if he still lived in Latin America. But because in this country we use our father's name, we're talking about Dank.
Does he speak Spanish?
The evidence was that none of the witnesses who testified, this was a tiny, tiny peripheral issue in the district court, none of the witnesses who testified knew. Now, Commander DeLopez, one of the city's lead witnesses on this justification, he doesn't speak Spanish either. Commander DeLopez's testimony is it's not speaking Spanish that is critical to improving community relations. These meetings aren't held in Spanish. It is the community's belief that its concerns are being taken seriously, and indeed Commander DeLopez's reassignment in the wake of...
It has a kind of weird racialist overtone. It's like the drop of blood. After all, you have a person, he has a non-Hispanic name, he doesn't speak Spanish. For all we know, he doesn't look Spanish or have any Spanish ethnic characteristics, Hispanic characteristics, but if he has some blood originating in the Iberian Peninsula or in South America, then he gets some special favor.
Well, it was South America, and it was documented through a birth certificate that identified his mother's name, so this is not a drop. And Judge Posner, this is a very unpleasant issue we're talking about. But it is our view that if there's going to be affirmative action, the fairest way to do it, rather than to engage in some kind of racial purity board, is to require a birth certificate, which is objective evidence, and to use the person who comes up next on the list in rank order to minimize
What percentage, we're talking about lieutenants here?
We are, Judge Posner.
So what percentage of the lieutenants in the Chicago Police Force are Hispanic?
At this time it was 4.5%, and that in fact leads to our remedial justification. The reason it was so difficult to prove the continuing effects of prior discrimination was that one of the reasons that there was underrepresentation was that there had been this explosion in the Hispanic population in Chicago. The Hispanic population went from 1.2% in 1950 to 19.6% in 1990. Nearly one out of every five Chicagoans was Hispanic.
But, you know, in the Whitmer case, because of the sensitivity of this kind of non-remedial affirmative action, reverse discrimination, in the Whitmer case, we emphasized that there was real evidence, there were experts about the need to have a black supervisor at this boot camp. And also, we said it wasn't a matter of percentages or anything like that. They just wanted to have one. Is there any evidence here, or are we supposed to just use common sense or something and realize that you have to have a percentage of Hispanics that somehow corresponds to the city population?
Well, I hesitate to quarrel with Your Honor or even comment on how to read Whitner. Your Honor knows how to read Whitner much better than I do. But as I read Whitner, the holding of the case is not one and no more. The holding is, when the felt exigencies that policymakers face are sufficiently compelling.
Yeah, but we did emphasize the fact there was expert testimony, and, you know, the decision has been criticized as going too far and inconsistent with the Supreme Court and so on. So it does, we may be skating on somewhat thin ice, but here we don't actually have any evidence, do we, about what percentage of Hispanic lieutenants is required for effective policing?
Well, here's the evidence we have. Now, in the Whitmer case, there presumably are three shifts at boot camp, just like there are three shifts everywhere else. So you wind up two-thirds of the time, if you have one African-American supervisor, you have zero African-Americans actually at the boot camp. We have three shifts here in the city of Chicago as well. Now, what the testimony
what
was...
What year are you referring to now?
1990, Judge.
1990.
Judge Coffey, the year at which the affirmative action plan was adopted. The testimony was there were only two to three Hispanics on any given Hispanic supervisors on any given shift citywide. And there was testimony not only from the Chicago police executives responsible for this policy, but independent experts, academic experts, and there was
referring to like the chief of police of Seattle who came.
I would begin perhaps with Professor Walker. And one of the things that's so interesting about Professor Walker's study is that he finds that Chicagoans of all races support greater minority representation in the upper ranks because it gives all races greater confidence in the ability of the Chicago Police Department to do its job. And this, of course, is not just hypothesized. There were, in fact, riots in the Hispanic community in the 1980s in Humboldt Park over police brutality, and Commander Lopez testified that the assignment of a Hispanic supervisor to that police district did a great deal to ease police tension. Superintendent Martin's testimony. There were many examples. Another that might be used is about Midway Airport. There was a recurring problem at Midway. with police officers harassing African-American motorists. Despite the complaints, it couldn't be solved until Superintendent Harlan sent out an African-American supervisor, and the problem stopped overnight. Now, these are unpleasant realities, but when you're running a police department and it is very difficult to supervise officers in the field who are generally on their own without somebody peering over their shoulders, there are enormous problems if one does not have the freedom to identify minorities who can be placed in supervisory positions in order to set an appropriate tone. Indeed, the evidence was equally clear that enhancing minority representation in the upper ranks enhances the sensitivity of police officers to these community relations issues.
Well, did Professor Walker testify about Hispanics specifically or just in general? Or?
He broke down his analysis to African Americans and Hispanics, Judge Posner. But there were some questions that some of the poll questions were about minorities generally, and some of them were broken down in between African Americans and Hispanics. The evidence was also, in particular, if anything, the evidence was more compelling on Hispanics as African Americans, because there were far fewer Hispanic supervisors in the Chicago Police Department, only 2 to 3 per shift. And at the same time, the evidence was that there are a number of coherent Hispanic communities with a significant problem of racial friction with the police department because these communities have very serious drug problems.
Could I ask, you said as of 1990, and I remember this, that we're pushing 20% in Chicago, 19-point-something% Hispanic. What was the percentage African-American in the community, not the police department?
It was 38.6% African-American in 1990, Judge Wood. This, and of course one cannot ignore that this rank is such a critical rank because captains and lieutenants are the people that supervise officers in the field on a day-to-day basis. They run the Chicago Police Department. For that reason, it is our submission that when there is a history of racial friction between the police and the minority community, in particular the documented history of racial friction in the Hispanic community in Chicago, enhancing Hispanic representation in the upper ranks builds community confidence.
Do you see this as principally an internal operation or an external operation benefit, or can you distinguish between the two?
Well, our submission rests on both prongs of that operational justification. Professor Walker's testimony goes largely to community confidence. Chief Stamper, the independent expert, his testimony, as well as the testimony of the Chicago police executives, although they also talked about community confidence, but they spent a great deal of time documenting the internal advantages of being able, in response to particular problems of friction, to bring minority supervisors to bear on that problem. The district court's ruling, the district court never addressed the sufficiency of the evidence on any of the jury's answers, and indeed they were inconsistent on African Americans and Hispanics, and even the plaintiffs don't claim that there's any evidentiary basis to resolve the inconsistency. The shortfall among Hispanics was far more aggravated than the shortfall among African Americans. Its principal justification for rejecting this as a matter of law was that there were a sufficient number of minority captains and lieutenants to address, in the district court's words, heater case. Now, not only is this a wholly offensive brand of racial tokenism, to pull the Hispanics out of the closet whenever you have a high-profile case and otherwise not to have them, but it misses the point of this evidence in the way that tokenism always misses the point. Bringing out Hispanics only when there is a crisis ignores the problems that exist when, on a day-to-day basis, the community in an area plagued by racial friction sees only white supervisors, deals with only white supervisors, and when subordinate police officers see the same pattern. It is the day-to-day interaction between the community and the police department where the confidence of the community is won or lost, and it is that day-to-day interaction when subordinates either feel impunity to engage in racial profiling and other abuses or not. The evidence supports the common sense proposition that it matters when police officers, at a minimum, know that the people that they are approaching, the people that they're dealing with in the minority community may know, may even be related to their bosses or to other high-ranking supervisors. It is an unpleasant reality that we deal with, that our society remains so racially stratified. But at least in 1990, Chicago Police Department saw a pressing need in order to protect the community, indeed, ultimately to save lives, to have this kind of flexibility. And when the public safety is at stake, this is why we say this case ultimately rests on the proposition that the Constitution is not a suicide pact. Because when the public safety is at stake, surely the views of police officers, as well as the academic experts, as well as the independent experts, should not be discounted so readily.
Counsel, what supports the trial judge's decision to grant a free trial to the city on the five individuals who were passed over for the four promotions in favor of the out-of-rank females?
The retrial, Your Honor, if I'm understanding correctly, the retrial was granted with respect to, because there were, the district court saw some flaws in the statistical evidence presented.
What was the reasoning? Just those flaws?
Twofold. First, the district court saw some flaws in the statistical evidence that was presented at the first trial. That the statistical evidence failed to account adequately for the fact that suburbanites should be considered in the applicant pool if they're willing to move into the city of Chicago in order to apply and get hired. And for that reason, the district court wanted the new statistical evidence presented because it couldn't calculate the shortfalls. The second problem the district court identified was an inconsistency between two special findings, 14 and 15. The jury found that there was still a shortfall caused by prior discrimination at the rank of lieutenant but not captain, and there was no evidentiary basis for that inconsistency because as a matter of pure statistics, if you, on this record at least, the statistical evidence showed if you're going to have a shortfall in one rank, you're going to have a shortfall in another rank, and there was no way to reconcile that inconsistency. The district court, in our view, did not abuse its discretion. We do respectfully request that with respect to the promotions of African Americans and females, the judgment be affirmed, and with respect to the promotion of Hispanics, the judgment be reversed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rosenthal. Mr. Horwitz, how much time does he have?
3.5 minutes. Okay. The Majewski case is different in the factual scenarios presented. First of all, Majewski did not have the LEAA report before it. Secondly, the city's expert in Majewski was a Dr. Mann, not Dr. Siskin, and he found, as set forth in this court's decision of Majewski, that from 1950 through 1990, there was a significant shortfall, significant statistical disparities in hiring of blacks. That's not true. Siskin admitted that from 1950 through 1962, it was virtually proportional hiring of African Americans in the Chicago Police Department. Where Dr. Mann got his information, we don't know, but in this case, there is a significant difference insofar as the statistics are concerned. In fact, Alderman DePray, who was cited, commented that under the administration of Wilson, it was the best integrated workforce of police force in the United States. The statement by counsel that the evidence is replete with incidents of hostility and tolerance of hostility toward blacks, as we point out in our reply brief at 8 and 9, is not a fair statement of the evidence. It shows there is absolutely no places in that evidence show any tolerance of racial hostility. You have incidents, isolated incidents of, as Martin said, Superintendent Martin said, of locker room talk. The riots that he mentioned in the Hispanic community in the 80s was a testimony by Chief Lopez that a female police officer asked some Puerto Rican women who were playing dominoes in the middle of the sidewalk to move, and there was an altercation. That's the rioting, he suggests, that happened in the 80s. There was an altercation because she didn't know that playing dominoes in the street or in the sidewalk was, as DeLopez says, was a custom in Puerto Rico. With regard to the claim that Mr. Dank was from Latin America, there's no evidence in the record of that. We don't know if he's from Latin America or his family came from Spain, and certainly if he came from Spain, he was not entitled to any type of affirmative action or of diversity rationale under this court's decision in the Builders Association. As we point out in our reply brief, if you look at all the instances where the city claims that these are instances of intolerance or hostility, they just don't show that to be at all true. For example, they cite General Counsel Cooper of the police department that he was not assigned to he was assigned to a straight shift, meaning he only worked days instead of rotating shifts. Well, that was done at his own request so he could go to law school. Yet the city cites that as a point of hostility and assignments. They have misrepresented the record on that point, and we ask that this court reverse the decision with respect to the appellants and affirm with respect to the appellee. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel.